Okay, so I will give a talk which I hope is not too general, but it will be somewhat general so that people who do not work in it will get something out of it. Now, we have had several, perhaps even many talks on various aspects of spin coherence in this program. I myself heard at least two, a very beautiful talk by Bill Koish and a really two D-force experimental talk by Amir Yacoubi. And of course, Charlie's talk also alluded to spin coherence. My talk will be kind of complementary to what Bill Koish talked about. I'm going to talk about spin coherence in the solid state spin quantum computation context, but specific topics I'll discuss are complementary to what he talked about, and I probably will cover more stuff. So the problem is a very old problem. It's a paradigm in both condensed matter physics, spin resonance, and people who like worrying about quantum decoherence, you know, people who make their living thinking about quantum mechanics. And it's a question of, you have one localized electron spin in a bath of nuclear spins. And sometimes this is called central spin problem. There are other problems which are called central spin problem also, but this is a standard paradigm. You have one localized electron spin, and you have a bath of nuclear spins. This electron spin will lose its phase memory. It will not maintain its quantum coherence, and the question is, how does it lose it? This is the only quantum decoherence problem I personally understand what the problem is. You know, I hear lots of talks, lots of papers with the word quantum decoherence, and I with no exaggeration, I will tell you, in most cases, I don't even understand what is being discussed, because it's often on a very philosophical level. This is a very, very well-defined problem. We know the Hamiltonian, we know what's going on, and because it's very well-defined, you cannot really use very lofty words. You really have to try to solve the problem, and we have made enormous progress. When I say we, I just do not mean I and my collaborators, but this community in understanding this 55-year-old problem. It was first posed in its pristine form in 1955 by Erwin Hahn, and I'll talk about it. So this is sometimes called central spin problem, spin bath problem. They're all the same thing. You have one localized electron spin, a bunch of other spins, which are nuclear spins, and this localized electron spin is losing. It doesn't have to be localized electron spin. It could be a different nuclear spin. It's losing its coherence, and what can we say about it? And to do that, and I will be talking specifically about this central spin problem, one localized electron spin surrounded by a nuclear spin bath. And so immediately you see there'll be at least two different coupling coming into the problem. One is the hyperfine coupling between the electron spin and the nuclear spins, all the nuclear spins, and one is the nuclear spin coupling, which is dipolar. And the energy scale difference, I'm going to discuss all these things in details. The energy scale difference between these two couplings is huge, many, many orders of magnitude. And at first, that sounded like a big problem. That how do you solve a problem where you have two terms in the Hamiltonian, which differ by many, many orders of magnitude, and both are important? In fact, that problem is going to be our friend. That problem is going to allow us to do what I want to do. Now, there'll be words like spin echo and free induction decay coming in. These are experimental techniques that people use to discuss the coherence properties. And this is the reason I like this subject. Here, the coherence is not just some philosophical term. It's extremely well-defined experimentally, operationally. So when I talk about a coherence time, it's actually is describing a particular experiment, a particular time experimentalist measure. And this is really a great advantage of this subject. It takes all the mystery, all the BS away from quantum decoherence. Quantum decoherence is not a philosophical problem here. Quantum decoherence is a very specific problem of asking questions like, can you describe experimental spin echo? Can you describe experimental free induction decay? There may be other problems in quantum decoherence which are this pristine, this well-defined, but I don't know about them. This one I know, and this one is unsolved, but we have made great progress the last few years. So, you know, we are talking about spin dephasing, and the terminology that will show up a lot is T2, and I want to define what T2 is right now. I will define T2 always with respect to a spin echo measurement, and I don't want to worry about whether the spin echo is falling off exponentially or not. T2 will be defined as the time in which the echo amplitude decays by the factor of 1 over E. So if it's exponential, then it's exactly T2. But it's not exponential, it's an operational definition that the experimentalists can measure. They look at some fall off, and they say, okay, how long do it take for it to fall off by roughly a factor of 2.7 or whatever? That's T2. I will think about low temperature finite magnetic field, but those are not so important. I will explain them when I get. I'll talk about semiconductors mostly, in particular phosphorus and silicon. Yes.
You're implying that, of course, that's not the way people always do these.
No, there is confusion in it.
T2G, T2 stars. Is
I will explain all those words, but everything I will, every terminology I use theoretically will have an experimental counterpart. There'll be a well-defined experiment that, so the question of is it exponential or not becomes moot, okay, the way I'm defining it. So I'll talk about...
T2 is not, I mean, it's not necessarily always a relevant quantity.
No, it's maybe never a relevant quantity, but to do theory, it's good to focus on something. Otherwise, it becomes philosophy. But I will not talk about T2. I'll give you the whole thing. But when I'm saying, when I do show T2, this is what I mean. So that I don't people, because typical thing would be I mention T2, and somebody who knows a little bit about the subject would say, oh, but it's not exponential. Okay, so all I'm saying is that don't say that because I'm not assuming exponential. I will talk a lot about phosphorus in silicon spin qubit and also about gallium arsenide spin qubit, but these are things you have already heard about it. And these are just actual experimental systems. I'm talking about one electron spin in a bunch of nuclear spins. And the theoretical technique I'm going to use, you know, standard diagrammatic perturbation theory doesn't apply to this problem because the standard Wicks theorem that you have, you know, the Feynman-Dyson perturbation theory cannot really do in the Wicks theorem way here. So you cannot even do a weak coupling problem. So you have to reinvent some problem. So you're going to do expansion in certain diagrams, but it'll be some kind of cluster expansion. I'll explain what that is, and then we'll do the summation. This is actually a very old problem, one of the oldest unsolved problems in physics. The problem is non-Markovian. Non-Markovian is a big word. I usually do not use it, but this is one case where it should be used. I'm talking about a decoherence. Now, what is decoherence? Decoherence is you have a quantum, you know, we learn early in quantum mechanics in the first lecture that you have stationary states. If you put a system in its eigenstate, it stays there because you have solved the Hamiltonian. Decoherence arises from the fact that you don't know your Hamiltonian. You only know part of your Hamiltonian. And you put it in the eigenstate of that part of the Hamiltonian. And the rest of the Hamiltonian that you do not know does things, so it causes decoherence. But this problem is non-Markovian, meaning it's not random in the Markovian sense, because the part that we are calling bath is controlled by Hamiltonian that we know. And the bath has, you know, memory, it has time scale. And so there is, if you want to say there is memory in the bath, so the problem is non-Markovian, and this is why the problem is difficult. And then, you know, central part of my talk will be how can we fight this decoherence? It turns out there are powerful techniques developed originally in the nuclear magnetic resonance community, and now rediscovered in the quantum computation community, and actually enhanced and expanded, that goes under the, you know, title of coherent control, dynamical decoupling, and the various kind of dynamical decoupling, and I'll talk at length about these things. And all these things, what they're allowing you to do, is that, again, we understand our decoherence mechanism because we know the Hamiltonian that controls the decoherence, the nuclear spin bath. If you know the Hamiltonian, since you're solving a quantum mechanical problem, you should be able to somehow fight the decoherence by doing various things, and I'll show you how that can be done. It's based on a whole bunch of work, on all of which Wayne Witzel, who received his PhD 2 years ago with me and then spent an extra year, it's his thesis work, and actually I just want to say two anecdotal things. Wayne's undergraduate thesis is in computer science, not in physics. And he came to Maryland to do quantum computation. I do not take students who want to do quantum computation. I take students who want to do condensed matter physics. So I told him that, you know, if he wants to work on the spin coherence problem, then he can work with me. And it turns out that his background in computer science was extremely important in his ability to solve this problem that others were not, and I was not. And actually now he's a permanent staff member at Sandia doing this sort of work, but in a computer science department. And the second thing I want to say is that, I don't know what's coming up, that of course other people, I worked with other people, and I'm going to show results with Roger Shudong, he's reading, sitting in the audience, Luke Sivinsky, and a very important paper with Benjamin Lee. And Benjamin Lee was an 11th grader in a high school when he worked with me. And we published a PhysRev letter in which he's the first author. And the PRL editors tell me is the only PhysRev letter in the history of PhysRev letter, which is a pure theory PhysRev letter, not no experiment, where there is a high school student involved. So all the bad things you hear about American high schools are in fact incorrect. He's a very, very smart kid. And he solved, you know, solved a non-perturbative problem. So this is the problem. Here is my electron spin. I have a magnetic field, so the electron spin is huge. The electron spin is huge because the electron spin Zeeman splitting is much, much larger than nuclear spin Zeeman splitting by a factor of 2,000. G factor is much larger. And so nominally, you cannot, and these are all the nuclear spins. I'm talking about a phosphorus electron spin in a bath of silicon. Now, silicon is an isotopic mixture of silicon 29, silicon 28, and actually silicon 30 also, which I don't have in the picture. Silicon 28, silicon 30 basically do not have any nuclear spins. They're closed shell. Only nuclear spins are silicon 29, which is about 5%. And this picture that I have says that, well, in a high magnetic field, you cannot flip this large nuclear spin, this small nuclear spin, because you have to conserve energy. At low temperature, you don't have any phonons or anything to take this energy away. So one of the main mechanisms will be this dipolar flip-flop due to two nuclear. So these two nuclear spins are coupled by dipolar coupling. And suppose they just flip their spins. This one spin goes down, this one spin goes up. That conserves energy. That's an allowed process. And the bath is happening all the time. What does the new electron spin see? What is the classical description? The electron spin sees a little fluctuating magnetic field. Remember, the millions of these nuclei. Yeah.
I guess since we spent so much time on what T2 is,
right,
I better ask what a bath is.
Bath is, yes, a good question. The bath is all these nuclear spins that the electron spin sees. It will depend on what system you're talking about, and it's non-trivial.
With the order of limits that there's an infinite number of them, does it need,
I will not,
is there a finite temperature associated?
No, I will not show you anything where we are going to take the thermodynamic limit. The bath here is not going to be infinite. The fact that the electron has a finite wave function in space and nuclear spins way outside do not couple will be very important in solving the problem. Okay? So typically I'm talking about a million, 2 million, 3 million nuclear spins that are in your quantum dot. In your quantum, yes.
And from a technical point of view, this is a problem, because I don't care if it's a million or
right.
20.
Yes.
The point is that it's a finite number, and that's okay with.
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. It's not only okay, it's also important.
So
for some of the things I'm doing.
Does that imply that there's a recurrence time? Or
there will be a recurrence time.
Save you from recurrence.
There will be a recurrence time, but often it's very long. We are not worried about that in this context.
That's okay. What I want to know, is that there will be a recurrence.
Correct.
And we're going to assume that N is sufficiently large that
we don't need to worry about.
The associated recurrence time is outside of this problem.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct, as it would be for quantum computation since you're interested in the initial time. But what the bath is a bit ill-defined. I mean, you are absolutely correct, yeah.
Well, but two things. One, your title said forever.
Yeah.
But the second thing is, why don't you define, why you define the boundary to be just a wave function of the electron? Because if those nuclei are diffusing or interacting
absolutely.
With the nuclei, why?
Absolutely. And it is not. It is depends on which part of the problem. When I do dipolar spin flip-flop, we explicitly check. We go outside. I'll explain it to you. Without the theory, you would not know. We have to explicitly keep on doing the summation until the number contributing is not of interest to us in the experiments I'm interested in. But in principle, if you're interested in numbers, which let's say you're interested in a spin coherence at 10 to the minus 100 of where it started, suppose you are for some reason, then you have to take all those nuclei into account. In fact, if you're interested in spin coherence at 10 to the minus 5,000, you have to take all the spins of the universe into account. It's a question of, like every other physical theory, it's a question of what you're interested in will determine how far you go. For things that I'm interested in, million to 2 millions are enough, is what I'm saying. Okay? And forever is also exactly the same. Forever, a few orders of magnitude, you know. So in principle, actually, it can be done forever. You'll need, the pulses need to go on forever. So I was not lying, but I will not be interested in forever because then it becomes philosophy, okay? I'll show you. When you see the numbers, you will understand exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
I got one of my two questions about the bath.
Good, I'll not finish the talk. I like this already.
Second question concerns, yeah. Presumably there will be ensemble averages over an ensemble of bath states,
yeah.
Which we assume to be mediated by temperature or something, which is keeping us the bath from being in some ground state.
Yeah, that I'll come to in a second when I show you the scales. You'll see that in a second. Okay, these are all good questions. Okay, but the only point I wanted to make here with this picture is that why does this electron spin diffuse decoher? You can already see it classically. Every time these two nuclear spins flip-flop, that is a random magnetic field as far as the electron is concerned. This is something that was already understood by Erwin Hahn in 1955. You know, at Berkeley. I just recently met him. and quite an amazing guy. And he talked about it. He knew this is non-Markovian. He actually made a theory of this because he didn't get to do this to understand spin echo. And he said, well, I'm going to assume the electron spins in the random magnetic field, which is temporally fluctuating, and I'm going to assume it to be Markovian. I'm going to assume it to be a Gaussian Markovian process. But in his paper, he says that this is a wrong assumption because this is not a random magnetic field. This magnetic field is controlled by the nuclear spins. So this is non-Markovian, but I don't know how to do that theory. So I'm just going to assume it to be Markovian. But you can already see on this classical level, semi-classical level, two nuclear spins flip-flopping will create a temporarily slowly fluctuating magnetic field at the electron spin. And the problem is hard because this temporal fluctuation is very, very slow compared to the electron's energy scales. And that's why the problem is hard. And this is what we want to do.
The
nuclear spins are quenched completely, but they can flip flop.
Some random distribution.
Yes, exactly. But we know what the distribution is.
Why doesn't that make it more
complicated? No, because they are still finite number. Okay, that's why. It's actually a very subtle process. So I will talk about two separate theories that came up in Bill's very nice talk, and he actually.
I don't think it is quenched disorder. I think if it were quenched disorder, there wouldn't be any decoherence.
Well, by position spatial, yeah.
But they must be dynamic.
No, I understand, but I was answering the question you're asking, yeah. Spatially quenched, yeah. So I'll talk about two separate things. Originally, I'll talk about spectral diffusion, where I will just take into account this nuclear flip-flop, the slowly varying nuclear dipolar interaction, because Bill already explained this problem very well, the low-field thing, and then towards the end, I'm going to talk about the low-field thing. Reality, of course, you have to do a theory which includes both. Once I see that, show the Hamiltonian, you'll see what I'm talking about. We have made enormous progress in bringing both of these together, but even our theory is not complete. So we'll see what it is. And the second part, which I know I'll not be able to finish, is in this very recent paper that just came out. But first part, I'm hoping I'll be able to finish. I should point out that Amir Yacoboli told you that that our theory actually works very well with his experiment, and the theory is a prediction. I did not even know he was doing experiments on this subject. He saw a paper on the archive and contacted us saying that that he's seeing this recurrence, not the recurrence Charlie was asking about, and it agrees with his experiment. And we have had a long-term collaboration with Princeton people, Steve Lyons, whose data in silicon data, I'll show you results, it agrees very well with this part. In silicon, it turns out for technicals, and this part is not very important. All right, so what do I mean by two separate? Let me just explain that right away. So this is the Hamiltonian. So I have a Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian interacting part of the Hamiltonian. One is the hyperfine coupling. I have coupling between electron spin, S, that just has no symbol, one electron spin, with all the nuclear spins that are coupled by this hyperfine coupling constant A, and this has, you know, you can expand it in a basis, and you're going to ignore this. It's called secular approximation because you're in a magnetic field. And then you have the coupling, the coupling among the J itself, which you have to take into account, okay? So the bath is evolving, and S, the electron spin, is continuously feeling kicks of this Overhauser field as they flip-flop, which lead to this. And these two processes, if you go to infinite B, flip-flop is all you have, okay? And this is the process we're going to talk about first. In infinite B, this is definitely the only process you have to worry about, but of course, at finite field, that's not true.
So, yeah. This is now your effective Hamiltonian, which falls from the first line.
That's correct.
And this Hamiltonian, you know, the coefficients B,
I'll show the Hamiltonian details just in two slides, okay, and give you the energy scale and everything, okay. So this is just, I'm going to go through it quickly. This is the T1 decoherence. A lot of people do not know this. I should show you. T2 star decoherence, somebody already asked that. T2 star decoherence is that when you have kind of an inhomogeneous magnetic field, Charlie talked about it at great length, and the two electron spins see different magnetic field nearby, and so they, although they are, their energy is constant, they get dephased with respect to each other, and this is something that eliminated by doing spin echo. This was a enhanced discovery, and T2 is what I'll talk about, which is so-called homogeneous broadening in the language of, so this is what Hahn found. We all know what it is, the racetrack analogy, that if things get broadened out inhomogeneously, then you can just apply this echo, a pi pulse, and just repeat the thing, then it comes back. And I'm mostly going to talk about the situation where you have eliminated a T2 star decoherence. We do not have inhomogeneous broadening, we have just homogeneous broadening. And to give you some numbers, in gallium arsenide, it seems the T2 star is of the order of 10 nanoseconds, 1 to 10 nanoseconds, depends on the details. And T2 is of the order of 1 microsecond to, let's say, 30 microseconds, something like that. This is, of course, spin echo. And so we'll be talking about the decoherence that remains after you have applied the spin echo. Okay. So I will not use Bloch's equation anywhere, but it's always good to have Bloch's equation to explain what's going on. So this is the magnetization due to the electron spin. So its evolution in time depends semi-classically on, of course, the applied magnetic field. You know, that just applies a torque. And then you have the decay of transverse magnetization. That's called T2. I think these names are given by Bloch. And then the longitudinal magnetization, which requires some energy relaxation. And I'm talking about this T2, which sometimes is also called TM, the spin memory, spin quantized coherence time. So I've color-coded here what affects what. So these brown things affect T1, and they all require some energy conservation breaking processes. You will need photons or phonons or something. If at very low temperature, I'll assume phonons have all frozen out, and this process is very, very long, and so T1 will be very, very long, and I think in all these systems you're talking about, T1 is more than a second. So T1 you don't need to worry about at all in the experiments you're talking about. Then you have T2 star, of course, anything that gives rise to different magnetic fields spatially. And you know that list could be very long. These are all just examples. So you can have unresolved hyperfine structure, you can have different G factors, you can have inhomogeneous fields, you can have unlike spins, you can have different nuclear environment because of this quench disorder that David was asking me. Again, you're not going to worry about it because you're going to do the spin echo, this will all go away. Then you have left. These are processes that cause true decoherence, true dephasing, and of which one I talked about, nuclear spins, which give rise to time-dependent magnetic fields, hyperfine coupling, and then you could have dipolar exchange coupling between like spins. Remember that if you build a quantum computer, you have many, many, many of these qubits, electron spin qubits. Those electron spins can, in principle, interact with each other, and one electron spin could cause dephasing in the other one. We're going to neglect this because those electron spins are very, very far, and then hyperfine coupling, we're going to neglect in the first part of the talk because we're in a very high magnetic field, and this process will be suppressed, so we're talking about this process, which is, really in some sense, the most difficult process, okay? So this is just a cartoon of what I just told you. After I eliminate everything, I have only this left. And this is what we're going to talk about first. And this is the spectral diffusion. We told you that the electron spin is getting random kicks in time from the fluctuating Overhauser field due to the nuclear spins. And this is what we want to solve. This is the problem we want to solve. Now you may say, well, what would happen if I can polarize all the nuclei? If I polarize all the nuclei, this process goes away, because this process is coming from the fact that the nuclear spins, and this goes back to the question Charlie was asking me, is it in the ground state? The answer is not in the ground state, because to go in the ground state, you have to go to below nanokelvin, because that's the energy scale of the electron spins. But if what about dynamic nuclear polarization? Suppose you polarize all of them. Good question. So we calculated that. In fact, Daniel first asked me this question. He may not even remember, I think, like 7 or 8 years ago. And the answer is something you can guess. This is a two-particle process. You know, two nuclear spins are contributing to it. So even if one nuclear spin is in the wrong direction and all the other ones are polarized, you'll have a lot of this flip-flop. So this is a very difficult process to eliminate with dynamic nuclear polarization. Even if you polarize up to 90%, you get only a factor of 2. If you do 99.9%, you get only a factor of 5. And the reason is that it's a two-particle process. Yeah.
Does the one-third power depend on an e to the minus t cubed?
Yeah, this one is within some model, but there is some power always. Okay. But so dynamic nuclear polarization is not going to help this process at all, because you know, best dynamic nuclear polarization you can do is of the order of 70% and so on. And the reason is obvious. It's a two-particle process. Let me not discuss the results. I'm going to show you the result discussed. So this is what you want to do now. So now, from this point on, is theoretical physics, a well-defined mathematical problem, which is very hard to solve. Solving the problem of nuclear-induced electron spin spectral diffusion due to the nuclear spin dipolar flip-flop, a non-Markovian quantum spin but decoherence problem. Okay. So let me give you the brief history of this process, okay? So originally, the importance of this process was appreciated by Hahn himself, and he actually, if you read this paper, actually a beautiful paper, he understands the non-Markovian process, he just assumes the electron is seeing a random magnetic field, and he's a Gaussian probability distribution. You know, a theorem in condensed matter physics is that if you go far enough, and in this case, it's if you go back 47 years, you see Field's name, Phil Anderson. Okay, and sure enough, he did something in 1962 with his colleague at Bell Labs. What he did, this is actually pretty amazing. It's a long paper. He took this paper, changed Gaussian to Lorentzian, because experiments did not quite agree with Gaussian, and it provided better agreement, but it's still all the assumptions of this, you know, the BAT was just eliminated. A very important paper that is not known in the West that much was discovered by Rogerio de Souza, who found this paper from the Soviet Union, from the former Soviet Union, and here, this is equivalent of these two together, but now these people actually said that, let's look at the nuclear flip, we'll assume that to be a Poisson distribution. And then the next advance was really by Rogerio de Souza when he did his PhD thesis with me. We said we are going to make this assumption that is the flip-flop is the basic process. Not single nuclear spin, not the magnetic field the electron is seeing, but the nuclear flip-flop. And you know, we're very lucky that there was not much work in this subject in these 50 years, and otherwise somebody would certainly have this idea. And this already gives you a lot of understanding, but I'm not going to talk about it. This is old work. This is not microscopic anyway. And you can see what we are trying to do. We are trying to understand this process so we can do hardware-based quantum error correction. So now comes the part that everybody is asking me about. Let's go through the Hamiltonian in some details. So you're in a magnetic field, so you have Zeeman energy of the electrons and Zeeman energy of the nuclei. And as you can see, they differ by four orders of magnitude, by factor of 2,000 or more, as I told you, because the G factor of electrons and nuclei differ by factor of 2,000 or more. You have hyperfine interaction between the nuclear spin and electron spin. We have had lots of talks on this. So there's a hyperfine interaction, and its scale is two orders of magnitude lower than even nuclear spin. And we know what its form is. This is its form. Okay, and this is the form we use in our calculation. Then you have the dipolar interaction, the intra-bath interaction, and that's the nuclear spin flip-flop between that and that has 10 to the power 10 squared. So you see, it's a 10 order of magnitude difference in the Hamiltonian of energy scale. Okay? And if you like temperature, then Charlie, this is the answer to your question. To go to the ground state, you have to be at picokelvin. Okay? And so our assumption would be, this goes back to the question, for everything we are doing, the electron system will be at zero temperature, and the nuclear system will be at infinite temperature. This is what allows us to solve the problem. Okay? This tremendous energy scale difference, and you realize that we do not need to solve the whole Hamiltonian. We can start with the assumption that electron spins are at zero temperature, electron spins at zero temperature, nuclear spins are at infinite temperature, and that's because of this energy scale. So now the form of the Hamiltonian, I'm going to, you know, so using this and I'm going to use the secular approximation. I'm just going to forget about the Z term. That simplifies things considerably. And now we want to now solve the evolution of the system according to this Hamiltonian. This is now a well-defined and very hard mathematical problem, which we have not done exactly, but we have found a technique where you can then, in a systematic manner, order by order, as we're asking, depending on how long in time you want to go. If you want to go to infinite time, our solution is as bad as anybody else's. But we do not want to go infinite time. That's the whole point. Infinite time is equivalent to infinite system size here, and then I don't know how to solve the problem. Okay. So, yes, please.
Could you now tell us
yes.
What the regime of lift is for this approximate Hamiltonian?
Maybe I'm not even understanding what you are asking. Regime of validity at what magnetic field, for example?
I mean, understand I correctly that this is now an effective Hamiltonian, which you get by some approximation scheme, or what is this?
I thought that it was the exact Hamiltonian. I thought it was not the effective Hamiltonian.
There are some wiggle lines here. There's not an equality sign. So
is this just a secular Hamiltonian?
Yeah, this is a secular Hamiltonian. That's all it is. This is the, let's talk about this one, okay? This one is just the spin-dipolar coupling. And if you know all these quantities, if you know gammas, if you know all the isotopes you have, there is no assumption here.
Okay.
And then we make a secular approximation. Only approximation secular. What you can ask, and you should ask, do I know when this Hamiltonian is enough? You know, at what magnetic field? And that we do not know. That we can only after the fact. And that, I think, is the many-million-dollar question, you know. And that's a very strong function, not only the material, also the dot size and all those things. I think this is the problem we as a community will have to face. Yeah.
So your B and then
yeah. Right.
This matrix
right.
Doesn't include this virtual electron spin medium.
No. No, absolutely. So when I said neglecting hyperfine coupling, that's what I mean. Of course, hyperfine coupling is the main thing. Later on, I'm going to put them back, but that will be a different theory. Okay? And the techniques you have used for these two theories, I don't know how to combine that to do one thing. Fortunately, it's not really needed what we showed recently down to 5 millitesla. But if you really want to solve a zero field problem, you know, or very low field problem, you'll need that, and I don't know how to do that.
Is there some sense in which that mediated interaction just renormalizes
No. That would be easy. No. It's not just simple RKKY you can do with anybody. You cannot just do some, I'm just going to reparametrize and call them finely liquid parameters. No, they bring in real non-trivial dynamics, which is different. Okay. All right, so then I'm going to now go through this part a bit fast because I wanted to explain the problem very clearly, okay? Because the reason I want to do that, I myself was completely confused when I started in this subject. Nobody explains the problem, I think I understand what the problem is. Then we want to calculate the Hahn-Eco envelope. We want to apply this, so Hahn-Eco, you are applying pulses, so you all know what the pulses is, so this is then the evolution operator, the standard unitary operator, and we want to calculate it. Okay, this is what we want to do. And we assume the nuclear temperature is high, in fact, we assume it to be infinity, much, much larger than nano-Kelvin, and then we solve this problem. And you have to calculate this quantity. You have to take the trace of this U, for the whole nuclear ensemble. This is what Charlie was asking. M is the number of nuclear states. It looks hopeless. It looks like it just cannot be done. You have millions and millions of nuclei. And I think this is why before us, nobody tried to solve this problem. And I think what I told Wen Witzel, I'll take no credit for this work. It's better, because I told him, look, this is an impossible problem. You are a computer science undergraduate. Why don't you see if you can do some quantum Monte Carlo or something like that? Maybe you can do much larger system than anybody else can because you have quantum computer science background. And he started doing it, and he's very powerful in symbolic algebra. And he said he thinks that with symbolic algebra, he can go very far. But then after 6 months or so, he came to me and he said he thinks this problem can be solved exactly. And I'll explain to you what he means by exactly. This is not, this work is 3-4 years old, and I know some people like Jake Taylor, Bill Koesch, and Daniel know the work very well, but most people do not know. It's rather ugly, but it's like any first solution, it's quite ugly. So what Wen appreciated was that the trick here is somehow to come up with some systematics and how the nuclear spins are contributing. If you try to do all the nuclear spins on the same footing, you got to solve the Hamiltonian, which is many billion by many billion or many trillion by many trillion in size, and then you have to do time evolution using that eigenbasis out of question. No computer will ever be able to do it. So he asked the question, is there any systematics in how these nuclear spins are flip-flopping? This is an idea I had also, but I did not know what to do with it. He figured out, because in computer science you do combinatorics, in the end it's some kind of a combinatorics problem. So the lowest order you have two nuclei, so two nuclei flip-flop spin. Next you have three nuclei process, one does it two does it three, on one does it four, and then four does it three. Then you have four nuclear process. What he understood is that they will contribute very differently. If he can somehow take care of each of these processes on its own, and since it's finite, but now you can see why I need finite number. If it's infinite number, we cannot do this classification. But with finite number, such a classification may be possible. And so the basic idea is simultaneously include all independent nuclear processes that involve clusters of nuclei of successively increasing size. And it's clear, as a size successively increases, it will contribute less and less. And then you actually do the calculation and see, can you systemize it? You can see we cannot go to infinite cluster this way. And if all the clusters contributed equally, which may happen in some other problem, there are problems where it happens, then this technique would not work. But if the contribution goes down in some systematic manner, it would work. And what we also realize that this cluster expansion is connected with how long in time you are going. So it's connected to the time expansion also. So longer you go in time, more clusters will contribute. In fact, originally we were thinking about time expansion, then you realize cluster expansion is better. And then there's some technical details, and I probably have to skip the technical details because I've already taken almost 40 minutes, 35 minutes, out of show results. It turns out that all of this can be systematically studied, and we call it a cluster perturbation theory. This is a non-perturbative perturbation theory by doing this cluster expansion, okay? And each higher order cluster have more orders of this quantity where B is the hyperfine coupling and A is that coefficient that we saw, and presumably this is going down in some systematic order, and you expect convergence if this quantity is small. If this quantity is large, so we cannot tell you beforehand whether it will converge or not. You have to do the calculation, see if it converges or not. Well, it's just
size.
The L is the size of the. Sorry, size of the. Right.
So is that L the same L as the neighbors?
Right.
Number of neighbors.
Right. Because they're connected. It's the cluster you're looking at, right? So then how you implement it is technically quite demanding because of the cumbersome way we did it, and this is where when being a computer scientist helped.
This convergence criterion down there, is right. that now valid for the whole range or only for this near-neighbor approximation?
No. It's not near-neighbor at all. You have to look at the results, otherwise you do not know.
Okay. So first line.
No, this is just motivating what, you know, that how you can see it may have some convergence properties. For the calculation, you cannot assume that. You know, you have to do the full thing, okay? And this is why we cannot a priori tell you whether it will converge or not, you know. But almost in all cases, when it didn't converge, you understood. Like, for example, Jake was working on the problem, was a diamond context you're using it? And when, you know, we are going to do it, and immediately it will not converge. I don't want to have a detour on why it doesn't converge for diamond, but you right away knew that it would not converge. You know, you have to do something else, okay?
Increase the density of the nuclei, then to some critical density, the convergence will start to work.
This, I do not think there is a critical density. I think it's a slowly shift. Okay, but you are thinking along the right line. Okay, I do not understand its convergence properties in general theoretical term completely because I don't understand the solution that well. You know, it's very recent.
Not for diamond. That's news to me.
Say it again.
Why doesn't this converge to diamond? In diamond case,
it's. What did you say?
It's the one-body terms that you did calculation before.
If you read them carefully, then that's.
You can, once you understand what the problem is, you can calculate that part exactly and so on. Yeah, once you understand, you can always do that. But I'm saying if you just apply it blindly, it would not work. Okay.
Can I ask a question about the parameter?
Right.
So is this line max an much greater than max
right.
bn derived from this small parameter lambda? Because
this is an order of magnitude
okay.
type statement, okay?
I mean, to be strict, I would say you probably want the minimum of an minus am to be large compared to the maximum.
Yeah, and then this condition will not be satisfied as well. Let me just emphasize something. All of these are just giving you dimensional argument that the theory may not be that bad. We actually do not make any of this approximation doing the calculation, and then you'll see, I'll show you successive order and how well it converges or not, okay? And so it may very well be that some of this you do not like, and you look at something else. So we have done all those things, and it, you know, depending on what you do, either the condition is soft or strong. In this slide, I may very well be showing you conditions which make it look very good. Okay, if you change the condition, the numbers may change for, you know, by only a factor of 10 rather than 4 orders of magnitude. Okay, but there better be a difference of some large number, otherwise this theory is not going to work. Okay.
Is the BNM just for phosphorus?
Yeah, these numbers are for, the numbers that I'm showing in all these arguments are phosphorus silicon, which is what our original motivation was, because that's why this effect is stronger than the hyperfine effector. So then I'm not going to talk about how you implement it because it's, let's say that when managed to implement it numerically, it's a, you know, it's a combinatorics problem, and the main problem comes from what do you do with overlapping pairs or overlapping triplets, or overlapping triplets are rare, but overlapping quadruplets, there'll be some overlapping. If you do not take into account the overlap, then you'll be double counting, and you must have, and you cannot do that by hand, you must have a systematic way of doing it, and when figured that out. So let me now show you the results for Haneko refocusing, okay?
So could you go back, because I just showed the result and I would like to
understand. Right, sure.
So you say now the calculation shows that the correction is order lambda times L.
Yeah, this particular quantity.
N-weighting argument.
This is,
this follows from
right.
the calculation.
Correct,
that's a
correct. This is a strict statement, yes. But whether they asymptotically sum up to something that you don't want or do not want, you have to still. So I'm going to show you now results for Haneko refocusing, and I'm showing you first phosphorus doped silicon where we had great success. So what is being shown, the dark lines are experiments from Princeton. And what is being shown is the envelope of how the equi-amplitude decays. Okay, so this is, so 1 over E drop here is your T2, okay? So you can see that T2 is very long, this is millisecond. So this is 200 millisecond. This is actually a very famous experiment by Steve Lyons where he found that the phosphorus in silicon, the decoherence time is 60 milliseconds. Is of the order of 600 microseconds. Later on, he went to 60 milliseconds by doing isotopic purification. And the point he made, this is some, you know, roughly here is 600 microseconds. Am I saying it right, or 60 microseconds? What is the correct number here?
This is probably a natural silicon.
This is natural silicon, yeah. It's on the order of 100 microseconds. What is the number? I don't remember the number. Do you remember that? 100 microseconds? What is the quoted T2? But I mean, this is still at that time 100 times longer than what gallium arsenide had. So that's what people are very interested in. But anyway, the dark lines are experiment. The red lines are theory. So what is changing? Well, changing is the angle. You're going from silicon 100 to silicon 111. So you're changing the angle. Since the interaction is dipolar interaction, which depends on F theta, there should be a systematic change in angle. And as you can see, experiment and theory, of course, do not fall right on top of each other, but by the way, theory has no free parameters at all. No free parameters. We take natural silicon, we know how, you know, that there are three isotopes, silicon 28, silicon 29, silicon 30. We just take from chemistry all the values of coupling constants. And then you're going from 0 degree to 60 degrees, and you can see the agreement is very, very good, given that there is no free parameter at all. For example, this bunching here, as you go close to 60 degrees, is being captured in theory. Here, they're very far separate, except for one feature, which I'm amazed that Charlie didn't ask me already. It looks like the experiment is completely noisy, except this is not noise, it's completely reproducible. That's the theory doesn't capture, theory is completely smooth, this structure you don't capture, and you didn't capture this big drop here. This is bad. So we have a very good theory for electron spin resonance or, you know, Hahn echo in silicon, but we have a very bad theory for quantum computation because most of the quantum computation will take place here, and the fact that it falls, you need to understand it. And, you know, my attitude to this is, oh, I'm not going to worry about it. You know, you cannot understand everything. But then we, in a conference, David Corey made a comment, and he understood that this is actually coming from a very well-known effect in chemistry, very unknown effect in physics, at least for me, which is called electron spin spin echo envelope modulation. It comes from the fact that there is a directional dependence on hyperfine coupling, which makes things noisy as you do this experiment. And so once you learn this, Shudong was involved in this calculation. These parameters exist. Somebody calculated all these parameters. Silicon is one of the few materials when these parameters exist. In physical review, I think in late 60s, somebody calculated it, right? And all these parameters are in a paper.
I think measurement was like late
60s. And so in all the parameters, so we took those parameters and just calculated this theoretical ASIM spectra, this electron spin echo envelope modulation, and this is the result we got in 0 degree, and that doesn't look really like experiment. Then you realize strain plays a very important effect. Strain is important in the systems. So when you include strain, you get this result. And all we did is add this to the spectral diffusion that we had. So you took these red cards and you just added the electron spin echo envelope modulation. Yeah.
This is direction of the field with respect to the crystal axis. This is right. Dipole. This isn't the fact.
The dipolar coupling, exactly.
Magic angle spinning gets
this, exactly. It is exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So with magic angle spinning, this doesn't appear.
Correct.
Is that the perpendicular axis?
Which one is part?
The green line.
That's just the echo, the actual echo. It's looking like one because we are not taking into account. So what we have to do is, this is just this envelope modulation effect. This is just the.
We don't have analytical hearing.
That's correct. So we have to add this to our red curve. Okay? And so once we are not going to add this because this doesn't look right, because this always comes back to the exact right place. Now we want to apply strain. When you have strain and we add it, I just want to show you results. This is really amazing agreement we reproduce. It's not often in physics that you get to reproduce noise-like structure. And the agreement, I'm telling you, you know, I do a lot of theory for experiments. Again, we didn't try to adjust anything to get agreement. Agreement is pretty good, and this is 0 degree. I'm just going to run through a few. There are fitting parameters, just two fitting parameters, this N and this TSD, the spectral diffusion. But the spectral diffusion we are taking from our theory, and agreement is very good. Let me just leave it there. We reproduce all the features of the experimental spectrum, you know, the bunching and this initial drop, everything.
Is there free parameters for each curve or free for each curve?
No, it's two free parameters per curve. Yeah. So it's not, it's because they must vary.
What's that? Per curve.
Per curve.
Set it for the answer.
Yeah. No. Per curve. Yeah, has to be because it is. But the free parameters are not, you know, they are just very innocuous. They basically control how the thing is falling off. They don't control the structure. They basically control the fall off, and they are in reasonable agreement with how you calculate, you know, the spectral diffusion. So, I mean, the point is that this is not a big deal because these are things that chemists do, but we are very happy with it. So then there is another issue that's very important. The reason there is a lot of interest in silicon quantum computation, in spite of, am I being taped? In spite of there being zero experimental progress, okay?
Yes.
You know, people wonder. Charlie Marcus is always asking me. Oh, Daniel is always asking me, well, why do they fund silicon? There has been no progress. And you know, it's a legitimate criticism, a legitimate question. And I don't want to defend, you know, the funding agency. But I, you know, you could ask the same question: why am I working on it? The reason is that in silicon, you have the possibility of eliminating decoherence completely. Silicon could become like Peter Zoller's system, ion trap. Because in silicon, we can eliminate all silicon 29.
But not only as long as this is being taped do I support funding silicon research, but I have two silicon projects
in
the laboratory.
See, Charlie Marcus is a wise man. Silicon is the way, right? So the reason is that silicon you can eliminate by isotopic purification all of silicon 29. And there are companies which are which specialize in this. So only problem is that for, I think, each percentage is decimal place, you know, if you want to go from 4.67 to 4.57, I don't know if it's 4, maybe at 4. If you want to change 4 to 3, you have to add a 0, okay? So it's 10,000, 100,000, then 10 million, 100 million, something like that. But people have 99.99% pure silicon now. People are doing experiments. So in principle, you can eliminate decoherence completely in silicon. I mean, this is, you know, this is a non-trivial thing. If you can do that, so what that means in silicon, if you can somehow make the qubit, everything should be easy. You don't need to worry about quantum error correction much. You know, coherence will be long enough. Before you, you know, get amused or laugh, Steve Lyons had actual experiments with silicon T2 of 200 milliseconds. In the bulk, not the surface. I should also tell you, near the surface, the decoherence goes down. We do not completely understand why, but we have a paper coming out on that. We have some proposed possibilities. So once silicon becomes like lithographic and so on, it seems this advantage goes away, but that's a different story. Bulk silicon measured, already measured T2 time is, no, it's more than a second. What I'm saying, Shuram, do you remember the number? It's 200 milliseconds is...
Oh, he had 0.3 seconds last time, I thought.
Okay, 300 milliseconds, okay? Already. I mean, that's a very long number. Because remember last week, Amir Yacoubi was justifiably bragging about 30 microsecond in gallium arsenide. If you take these two numbers without any qualification, silicon is a factor of 10 times 1,000, 10,000 times ahead. Okay, just on decoherence. So that's the reason silicon research goes on. It's a very important thing, and I think in silicon, if they make qubits, then the question we should gallium arsenide be funded. Okay. So now the point is that, can you understand that theoretically is the question I'm asking. Can our theory predict the fractional dependence, how as you go from, you know, 4.67% silicon 29 to 0% silicon 29, how it goes from, you know, whatever number now it is to infinity? And the answer is yes. So what I'm showing you here is that how the log of Hahn echo as a function of the time separation changes as you go from 100% silicon 29, okay, to 5% silicon 29. So the red curve is when you have isotopically very bad silicon, and it's natural silicon. This has been experimentally done. This is done by Ito in Koei University in Japan. And you can see that you have much more coherence when you have natural silicon, because natural silicon has only 5%, and it'll keep on growing in this direction.
What's on the vertical axis?
Vertical axis is the Hahn echo. How it's,
what do you mean the Hahn echo?
The log of the, how is the echo is decaying as a function of tau. Log of that.
Is it time?
Yeah. No, it's not a time.
Is the number of echoes?
No, it's how it's decaying.
Amplitude over initial amplitude?
Right. So it's the fall off. It's
just a logarithmic
plot. Is this thing, how it's falling off. Okay.
Are you applying
the exponential form? What is the how do you take a log of it?
What's coherence? It's just
It's a log of the signal. I don't. Not even. Only thing you need to compare here, Charlie, is the blue versus red. Forget everything else. Okay. seriously, this is irrelevant now.
You know, it's not outrageous for me to ask what's on the vertical.
It's completely reasonable for you to ask. Completely reasonable. But I cannot tell anything more than what is written here.
No.
You can ask me, but it says here, I'm just going to repeat, it's the natural log of Haneko. It's how it's falling off, you know.
You start with a 1. So
you start with 1.
It's 0, right?
Okay.
So if you go, time goes to negative infinity, you'll get to
0. Okay. So if you go over there, this thing will be 0 and that thing will be 1.
So one can, the prior scale, the one you're just showing,
right,
is the Haneko scale.
Right.
And it's always normalized between 0 and 1.
Exactly, yeah. It's 1 when you start, it's 0 when you go to infinite time. And we're just showing you a piece in the middle because you're showing log-log scale.
Is it 0 only problem? It's my present problem.
But do you understand now? Has your question been answered?
I don't understand.
Okay. And so only thing we're interested in how much is changing. Okay. And you know, the slope here, I should tell you, the slope here we find is roughly 2.3. This is an empirical slope. There is really no real number. You know, this 2.3 comes out, and the shift, you know, there is some shift. And the only point I wanted to make, this shift that we get theoretically is exactly the same shift that you get experimentally, okay? I mean, this is what they saw. I remember the factor of 5 or 6. And this actually we did not get in Roger's theory. So this is kind of a triumph of the theory because, again, there is no fitting. So basically you can say that the T2 time will vary as a function of fraction as this 0.87 power. You know, it's not 1, not 2/3, roughly it's 0.87. And that's actually is what experimentally is seen by this Abe et al. Paper, which came out in PhysRev a few years ago. The experiment was done before theory. And that is good. So that shows in silicon this theory works well.
Can I go back one thing? Yeah. Log slope of minus 2.3 means it's a power law of something raised to the power 2.3.
Right.
So I don't think it's exp. I think it's whatever V sub E is.
V sub E is the echo amplitude.
Yeah, okay, then yeah. I think it should be V sub E of tau equals tau to the minus 2.3.
Well, maybe it's doubly log.
Yeah.
If you read the...
Yeah. Oh, it's a doubly log. Yeah, this is doubly log, yeah.
The logarithm.
You know these two laws that people talk about?
Logarithm of the log.
Yeah, log log.
The quantity is the logarithm, and then we take the logarithm and plot it on the log scale.
But Charlie, a question can be...
Logarithm of...
It's log 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 log.
The numbers... It's a log 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 log.
Yeah,
no.
Bracket log log.
No, log log.
Log log.
Log log. But, in fact, you'll get the answer. You know, there are two laws.
Log log log.
No, let me tell you what it is. You know, the two formulas that come out, one is power 2, one is power 4. You know about that? Either you get T squared law in the exponent of T to the power 4. What you are saying is neither 2 nor 4 is something like 2.3.
Okay.
Okay? I knew that answer you'll understand right away, okay?
Yeah, so that's okay. So it's a log of a log.
So I may have even written it wrong. I just don't want to go there because that's a pointless discussion. It's neither 2 nor 4 is 2.3 is what we are saying, okay?
Is the agreement with experiment based on more than just 2 points? More than just the
I don't remember. I mean, you know, there is just one experiment, so one cannot really.
Does the experiment have many fractions, many f's?
Oh no. The experiment did not have many fractions. This particular experiment did not have many fractions. They just used two fractions.
Scaling of TM.
Yeah. They used just two fractions. Right. So it's not very satisfactory. It would be nice to have this. And now what do I remember? I think Steve has unpublished results is consistent with that because it's in the thesis of Wayne. I cannot remember it. You know, Steve is very slow in publishing. Steve has unpublished data for something like 10 fractions or something like that, which agrees. But this paper, which is the only published paper, is just...
How stable is this power?
It changes, as you can see.
If you introduce new isotopes, more silicon 29, then the power will actually change.
This is actually in that regime, but this is not a power law. This simulates a power law. I'm not going to say anything more than that.
The power talk in your...
Yeah, so I cannot tell you how this power will change well outside this regime because I certainly don't remember it. If Wayne was here, maybe he would know the answer. But this.
I'm curious about this scaling of TM with F. So how far should I trust?
Believe it.
That depends on this thing. Not.
You should believe it in the regime this experiment is. That's the parameters we looked at.
0 to 5% or something.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly. Yeah.
So the.
But you know, this works up to this 300 millisecond number that Steve has, which I believe is 99% pure or 99.9, okay? That also agrees with that, although that's not published results, so I'm not talking about it. I don't even have access to this data. It's not even anywhere.
Okay.
One more question. Yeah. You show the data for f equal to 100%.
No, that was, this is here.
So does your method still,
valid.
This approximation still valid even if all the
results are? Yeah.
Then you have many.
Right. That it should not depend on that. It depends on
effectively the number of neighbors.
That's correct. So the calculation, you know, it will give you a different number, but the theory still you can apply. I'm not following what you're asking.
I mean,
theory did not.
In
gallium and arsenic, where I'll show you the results in a minute, there every nuclear spin contributes. The theory doesn't limit itself to that at all. Okay.
The lambda times L doesn't depend on the number.
That doesn't depend on that number. It depends on what the coupling constant of those things are. Okay. How does it converge? This is going to take a very long time if I really spend a lot of time on it. Let me just tell you that you clearly see the regime where our cluster. So how do we do that first? Well, we do calculation of two clusters, three clusters, four clusters, five clusters, six clusters, and just compare. Okay, that's the only way we know how to do it. That's a direct comparison. And what you want is that if they all start contributing up to which point we have gone, five clusters are contributing as much as two clusters, then you say, well, clearly we have to keep six clusters, seven clusters, somewhere you will not be able to do it. So wherever you don't have huge separation between the scales, you would say the thing is not working. Okay? Maybe it will work a bit longer, but it certainly we cannot trust it. So you can see, as I told you, that by the time it fails, you have gone fairly long in time. And you have gone fairly low in your coherence. But this answers the question you are asking, Jeremy. This is why we can say forever. Forever is not forever. Forever is, you know, it depends on what you're interested in. If you're interested in quantum computation, you don't care about this part. You care about this part. And in that part, it works very well. Okay?
I want to understand, this is a failure then of the calculation?
Cluster expansion.
Intrinsically, or if you compare it to
No, this is exactly what I'm saying. We do a calculation. This is like doing perturbation theory. Let me give you an example. You're doing perturbation theory, some parameter. You do parameter lambda, lambda square, lambda cube, lambda 4, lambda 5. This is just like that. And over here, contribution from lambda 5 and lambda to the power 1 are the same. So now, it may be the theory is not failing. Maybe if we do lambda 6, 7, 8, 9, they'll all contribute the same way you can sum, but we have no reason to say that. So by failure, I'm not saying anything profound. All I'm saying, empirically you're finding that at this time, the fifth order cluster is contributing the same as the first order cluster. So we're saying failure of cluster expansion. That's all. Okay? It may very well be by doing something clever we can preserve it, but we are not, you know, we are not comfortable doing that. That's all. It's a very simple statement that when the various large clusters start contributing the same as the small clusters, that's failure.
But you still have this small parameter, this parameter lambda times L.
But you play
now and say, make this parameter smaller, does this point then move out?
Absolutely. But there will always be a point, because now what is happening, there are many, many, many five clusters. That's what it is, okay? You have a small number, you're multiplying it by a very large number. This again goes back why you cannot do this for an infinite system, okay? All these things are connected.
Does lambda really, is it independent of the concentration of silicon 20?
No, it's not independent. The way we define lambda.
How would it?
I don't remember. But you know, this point will shift depending on the silicon concentration. But you can calculate that. Okay. I don't remember, so I don't want to give an answer. Okay. I do not think it's very sensitive in this range, in this small range. Okay. That's all I can tell you. But I don't remember the details. It may or may not be in our paper. If you're interested, just drop one a line. He would know right away. Okay. I just don't remember. So now you know. I do want to talk a little bit about how we fight decoherence. So far, everything is talking about a spin echo. This idea goes back to mid-50s, you know, Carr, Purcell, Maiblum, and Gill pointed out, why stop at spin echo? Because spin echo just is using a pi pulse. Why don't you combine these pulses and just, this is pi pulse, you know? You put one pi pulse and do the same thing, that's spin echo. But keep on doing it, an even number of times, you'll continuously improve your coherence. It's a very simple idea, and it's used extensively in NMR and other contexts. So you want to see what that does for spin coherence in solid-state context. We're the first, actually, to take these sort of things seriously. We are not doing it from any kind of quantum computation consideration. We're just doing it from our knowledge of spin resonance and nuclear magnetic resonance, that this improves things over spin echo. And I remember being on the phone with Charlie Marcus and telling him he should do it. And he actually told me he did it, but he never published it. So
I showed it yesterday, my
dear. Yeah, you did. It did. And so this is enhancing. So this is the first one is spin echo. So what I'm drawing it, there have been a lot of problems in what my ordinate lapses are. This is the echo envelope. So there is no confusion, no log or anything. And this is the time. So I'm showing you. So here is for gallium arsenide quantum dot. First time I'm showing you gallium arsenide quantum dot. One pulse, so this is Hahn. Two pulse CPMG, four pulse CPMG, six pulse CPMG, because you can apply it as many times as you want. You can go 8, 10, 20, it doesn't matter. Now, Jeremy, this is what he meant, that you can keep it coherent forever. Because you're interested in this part, and literally, I can show you 8, 10, 20. We can do this indefinitely as long as you want, because you don't care about this part in quantum computation. You care only about this part. Now, of course, this is not true in a real situation. In real situation, you heat the system up. In real situation, the pulse duration, each pulse is finite, that will come in. But in principle, if you could create absolutely idealized delta function pulse and they did not heat your system, you had perfect control in your pulse generator, then you can fight this decoherence forever using SIM. No, you don't think so? Why not?
No, so you're saying it's still a problem.
What is still a problem?
I mean, okay, you solved it theoretically, but there's still...
So experimentally, you'll have a finite resolution somewhere. For example, experimentally, at some stage, the fact that each pulse is finite duration will come in, and you have to take that into account, which we cannot in our theory. Experimentally, it'll heat up the thing, that will have a problem. And those are all problems. But in theory, one has to separate what is in principle possible in an ideal system. And it's a very important, interesting question. How long can you keep, for example, 99.9999? How long? I do not know. It's an experimental question that I think is really should be addressed. And I even Steve Lyons, every time I ask him, do CPMG, he gives me some reason that I don't understand. He says something about pulse generator and this, that. I don't understand it at all. And so, and you can see both in silicon and gallium arsenide, you can do that and it should be done. So I was happy seeing. And here also, same thing would happen, that as you go to long time, our theory will fail. And this is what you're seeing, okay, where the cluster expansion starts failing. So I do not want to overemphasize the validity of cluster expansion, okay? Some will fail, but fortunately we can systematically, and as you put more and more pulse, its failure starts earlier and earlier, obviously, yeah.
Is the flip-flop terms of the hyperfine interaction is included or neglected in this calculation?
No. Hyperfine coupling flip-flop is completely left out. There is no RKQI. It's just dipolar flip-flop. Nothing I'm showing you has hyperfine flip-flop.
Right. So okay? In reality, we do have...
That's right. So what I... Absolutely. So these are... These should be compared in the experiment. Let me just quote a fantastic field, 10 Tesla in gallium arsenide, and just one Tesla in silicon is enough, to fit. But I'll show you those results. Don't worry about it. These experiments have been done. So later on, purely, it turned out that I did not know about this paper, that in the quantum computation, although it's a very well-known paper, it's just I don't read... papers in quantum information theory. So this paper actually kind of rediscovered Hahn echo and these things and gave it a different name. This is really just Hahn echo. And later on, people realized, this paper and others in 2005, that you don't have to do what just repeats Hahn echo. You can do better. You can concatenate it, and that will give you still better results. So for example...
Could you make that Koan-like title of the view graph? The Hahn echo does more than refocusing. It is also a dynamical decoupling sequence.
Right.
What does that mean?
That means that I'm paying my homage to quantum information community. They like the word dynamical decoupling. Okay, which basically means that you're decoupling your test spin, your electron spin from the bath by applying these pulses. And that's exactly what Mr. Hahn did. He decoupled it from your static nuclear magnetic field fluctuation. That is a zeroth order decoupling.
What's refocusing?
Refocusing is another way of saying the same thing. You cannot use both words. It's but you can do
the same. It is Hahn echo does more than X,
right?
Also does X.
Correct. But for Hahn echo, no, hold on. For Hahn echo, they're exactly equivalent. But once you accept the dynamical decoupling spin, so Hahn echo does nothing more than just refocus. You're absolutely correct. But once you accept the dynamical decoupling spin scheme, then you say, if I continue Hahn echo, if I combine it or concatenate it, it should be able to do more. That's all I'm saying here. Maybe it's not stated very well. Okay?
Maybe as sort of an example case,
right?
If we think about the hyperfine mediated term, which is so far,
right,
it is proportional to SC.
Yep.
Electron spins.
And the direction.
When I do echo, not only do I undo the refocusing part,
But I also turn on this, there's a two-body interaction which flips its sign.
Right.
So
right. Okay.
So that might be an example of distinction between the first line.
I see. So a Hahn echo is good for refocusing in a fixed static bath.
Basis, yeah.
Whereas if the bath can be affected by the spin,
okay, good.
You can do
that's exactly what I'm saying. Right.
Stir, unstir the bath.
And so this consideration led to this concatenated scheme where you take any particular sequence that you love and then repeat it. So you repeat that nth time. So n plus 1 nth sequence will be repeat whatever you did before, add an x rotation, then do that again, 0. There could be many other possibilities. This is just pointed out in this paper. This paper also considered this. So we, you know, since we have a full theory, we have the cluster expansion technique, Wynn just went ahead and applied these dynamical techniques, and we'll call them periodic dynamical decoupling, okay, versus CPMG, okay? So in some sense, the CPMG is nothing other than this concatenation scheme taken to just second order, okay? Just second order. But you don't need to stop at second order. You can continue. That's the idea. And, you know, so here is a comparison of, so Hahn echo is the first order concatenation, CDD1. CPMG is a second order concatenation, but you can go four pulses, CDD3, so it'll give you some improvement, okay? In most cases, I should tell you, we conclude CPMG is enough. You aren't going to get much more improvement after CPMG. Let me not discuss this again, you know, when Witzel is absolutely obsessed with the validity of, he's a very careful guy, validity of the cluster expansion. I'm not going to spend much more time. This thing is coming in here because all the work of Lu Shan's group is assuming pair approximation. And pair approximation completely fails in silicon is the only point we're making here, okay? Something that group did not know, okay? I mean, they compared with our results and say, pair approximation is enough. All this work they're doing is unnecessary. But in silicon, pair approximation is not enough. That's the only point here, okay? So let me just now show you some, you know, we have many results on this. These are all in the papers. Point is not. So let me just go and talk about, it doesn't look like I'll be able to talk about very recent work, a new breakthrough in this whole subject where this Götz Jurig, who, in a talk I said he came from nowhere. He's a very well-known guy in strong correlation physics, but he has never worked on this. I got this preprint from him in an email and saying that, well, you know, I have this thing which I derived based on spin boson model. Spin boson is a totally different model of decoherence where you couple your test particle or your test object, test two-level system to a bath of bosons. You can see it's as different from spin as anything can be, right? Because spin is a two-level system, up and down, two levels. Bosons, you know, they're harmonic oscillator, they go forever. So it's a totally different model. But theorists love spin boson technique ever since the work of Calder and Leggett. So spin boson is a very standard way of studying decoherence in physics. And so this Professor Jurig, using spin boson technique, came up with a scheme of pulses. This is very, very nonlinear transcendental function. It's a very important paper, by the way. Nonlinear transcendental function, which he showed for spin boson technique, it works extremely well. So he wanted us to test his pulses on our spin bath problem. And I must confess, I like many other papers that I receive asking me to read it, I deleted it since I didn't know his name, didn't look at it. He sent me the email, I think, more than once. Then he did the right thing. He contacted Wynn. And it's actually, you know, I had goosebumps. This is one of those things that because I was sure for spin bath, this would be very bad pulse sequence. Because just spin bath is so different from spin bosons. And you can see the advantage of this Jurig sequence. It's not concatenated. The number of pulses is going up only algebraically. So here is a comparison of concatenated scheme versus Jurig scheme. At first order, there's not much change. But look at this. In fifth order of CDD, you have as many pulses as 21st order of UDD. So if UDD works, you can go to much, much higher order for doing your fighting of coherence. It's a very, very important paper if it works. And let me show you that it works reasonably well. Not always, and I don't have time to discuss. It works actually very well. I mean, so I'm showing you comparison, a very busy figure, but in gallium arsenide quantum dot, which is what most people are interested in. So you can see that, let's see, where is the black line? This is black line, again, log of spin echo, falling off, UDD5. It's not as good as CDD5, but CDD5 involves 21 pulses. UDD5 involves only 5 pulses, okay? So, you know, so if you go to UDD 21, which will be 21 pulses, it of course beats everything. So for example, you should really compare the number of pulses, not this concatenation order. That's very misleading. Experimentally, it will occur how many pulses. So if you say that 21 pulses, UDD 21 is here, okay? CDD 21 pulses is here, so it's a huge improvement. So we think that this unique thing is very, very important. Then we applied these things for superconducting qubit. I have no time to talk about superconducting qubit. Let me just show you, I'm going to conclude because, you know, it's going on for a very long time. And I am grateful that some of you are patiently sitting here. So we wrote a paper really advertising this unique work enormously with Benjamin Lee, and we made a conjecture. We made a conjecture for wide class of Hamiltonians that I'm not going to go in. This unique decoupling sequence is perfect. Absolutely perfect. Something that he derived for spin boson technique applies to spin bath technique with perfection. We could not prove it mathematically, although I was absolutely convinced that it's mathematically true, because it's one of those things. When you do the numerics and you see it, you know, I know it from my quantum hall. And so I, you know, Benjamin Lee came to work with me in the summer, and I said, prove this, because it can be proved, and these young kids are extremely good in computer. He proved it by symbolic manipulation, I think, something to like 30 orders, but he could not come up with a mathematical proof. So he wrote a paper showing how good UDD is for the spin bath problem, and conjecturing the result is exact. And a year after that, Renbao Liu and his collaborators provided a mathematical proof. Now, if you think that this is an easy topic, it's not an easy topic, because in between, a paper was posted by two very, very brilliant mathematical physicists, very senior, meaning senior to me, John Cardi and Deepak Dhar. These are people who make their living proving theorems. So they posted a paper saying it is proven, and that proof was completely wrong. They withdrew the paper. And so it's a non-trivial proof, but it's exact. And this got a lot of sensation, so people out. So
can you say something more precise about what exact means in this context? So if you optimize over the number of pulses?
Yeah, yeah.
For a given time?
It's in certain situations, and what the certain is, I don't want to tell you right now. In certain situations, UDD will get rid of all decoherence. Okay? All. I mean, it will give you back the original thing. That's the statement, okay? And spin bath problems often satisfy this condition approximately. Okay, and I want to just leave it there because it will become a totally different talk otherwise. But what I want to end by showing two experimental papers, which are very important because of all this discussion on this. Amazingly, people who got motivated by it came totally from non-quantum computation and non-spin community. This is a disappointment for me, that the spin community or quantum computation community really seems to be not that interested in understanding quantum decoherence. So one was Michael Berchuk, who was Charlie Marcus' student. He was a postdoc at NIST, and he did not know anything about ion trap. He called me one day and he said he has read these papers. Did I think that this experiment on coherence can be done using ion trap? I said, yeah, it's a two-level system. If you can do this experiment, it can be done. And he did this experiment, and he showed that this UDD is very good. He did CPMG, he did UDD, and in fact, that points are shown, and the solid lines are the theoretical simulation. He also did theoretical simulation. It follows the theory exactly. So this is an ion trap. This was published in Nature and got written up everywhere, including Physics Today and everywhere else. It created a sensation. Again, outside the spin community, outside the quantum computation community, although the motivation came entirely from spin quantum computation community. And then there is even a more recent paper, just a month ago, where a group in Hefei, China, these are a group of chemists, and they were motivated by Renbao Liu, who knows a lot about this subject in Hong Kong. These are a bunch of chemists who do electron spin resonance measurements. They use some organic molecules, okay? But you know, the experiment has nothing to do with what the molecule or the system is. It's a question of spin echo, if you can do spin echo. And they compared UDD experiment and theory extensively. Again, there is no time to go through all the details. I don't understand all the details. In fact, none other than David Oshelam wrote one of those praise pieces that, you know, Nature loves, praising itself. Aren't we great? You know, so in the same issue of Nature where this paper came out, David Oshelam has a two-page article saying this is a breakthrough experiment, you know, great experiment. I wish I did this experiment. That sort of stuff. And you know, he's right. This experiment should have been done by somebody in spin quantum computation community. And basically what they showed that you can prolong coherence, not forever, but for a very, very long time. And this was done in some molecules which are, you know, where they did spin echo measurements in some details. So I'm going to conclude because I myself am exhausted now. And I'm not going to talk about the hyperfine part unless somebody asks me. I have a few slides, two or three slides, summarizing what we recently did. So the conclusion is that I'm just going to conclude the most exciting part, which is that this UDD, we named it UDD. I thought we named it URIC dynamical decoupling, but URIC thinks it is universal dynamical decoupling. So both works. So it's quite universal for any diffusing Hamiltonian, although URIC created it for the spin boson problem. It cancels successive orders of time and Magnus expansion for each pulse. This is what I mean by exact, okay? That it precisely cancels successive order. CDD cancels orders both in a time and Magnus and interbath expansion for each quantum condition. So we actually have written papers very precisely distinguishing the two and saying where you should use one versus the other. I'm not going to go through it, and if I try to go through it, I'll make mistakes. So CDD has the advantage that it does interbath cancellations. UDD has the advantage that it's linear. So if you go to a certain order, CDD is always better than UDD. But what we found, if you go to a certain number of pulses, UDD is always better than CDD. So, you know, so if you're scaling in number of pulses, you know, basically if you have some hard cutoff in your noise, then UDD is very good. That's the bottom line, okay? So superconducting problems, I think, will be very good, very hard cutoff, okay? And the details are in this paper, and I am really going to stop there because I don't want all of you to walk out by the time the talk ends. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.